Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to the University Libraries Colloquia Series hosted by Libraries Computing and Technology. I'm Ruth Ann Jones, one of the organizers of the series. Our speaker this afternoon is Dr. Curtis Stokes from MSU's James Madison College. Professor Stokes has his PhD in political science from the University of Michigan. His research interests focus on liberal and Marxist political theory and on African American politics. And he is the author of two books, The Evolution of Trotsky's Theory of Revolution and a forthcoming work entitled Black Leadership, the Failure of Theory and Practice. He also served as Assistant Director of African American Studies at Columbia University from 1995 to 1997. Professor Stokes has been recognized frequently as an outstanding teacher as well. He received an Outstanding Faculty Award from MSU's Senior Class Council in 1991, a State of Michigan Teaching Excellence Award that same year, and the Distinguished Faculty Award from MSU's Office of Supportive Services in 1993. He'll be speaking to us today on the future of African American politics, liberalism or liberation. Please welcome Professor Curtis Stokes.
Wow. Thanks very much, and let's make sure this is working here. So, how am I projecting? I mean, I boom with the Baptist side of me. It really projects. But thank you very much, Ruth, and I really am delighted to be here and be a part of this wonderful opportunity to engage folks with similar interests around the issue of African-American politics. Certainly, that's an issue that's been dear to my heart for many years, and I continue to do a lot of research in this area, as well as teaching courses in this area, as you rightly noted. I also am pleased to see the turnout today. I mean, it's certainly 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's not always easy to get folks to show up at 3 in the afternoon to listen to a talk, but a number of brave souls did show up, and so I'm really, really grateful about that. Now, basically what I want to do today is to talk for perhaps about 45 minutes or so, if I can restrain myself, but at least that's the plan. Go about 45 minutes, more or less, and essentially at that point then open up for dialogue, questions and answers, comments, whatever the case may be. There are essentially three areas I want to focus on. Something's getting on me here. I don't know what it was for a second. There are essentially three areas I'd like to focus on, one of which, of course, would be, first of all, to present a preliminary definition of black politics. I mean, I think it's important to get a handle on what that means, not just from my perspective, but also from the standpoint of how others might conceive African-American politics. Secondly, I will spend some time looking at what I refer to as the results of 125 years of black liberalism. And finally, spend some time pointing towards the future regarding African-American politics. Now, first of all, let me talk some about the meaning or meanings of African-American politics. Among the many misleading or narrow understandings of black politics is one that values it first and foremost as a question of culture. This can be seen, for example, in struggles to emancipate, supposedly, blacks from forms of mental enslavement. This particular view is found, for example, in the writings of Malafi Asante and others from that school of thought. Alternatively, it is primarily centered upon the idea of registering blacks to vote, voting, attending elective offices, and having access to those with power. I mean, this is a view of African-American politics as well, and it is a predominant view. That is to say, it has a kind of electoralist ring to it. And an interesting essay from the mid-1960s by Bayard Rustin, the architect, the principal architect of the famous 1963 March on Washington, which is titled From Protest to Politics, nicely sums up that perspective, which would gain a lot of influence, particularly after the adoption of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. However, in an influential essay published in 1970, titled A Frame of Reference for Black Politics, Political scientist Mac Jones correctly indicates that one must understand black politics differently. First, by examining factors, quote, unique to the black political experience, unquote, which includes, I might add, embracing a broad rather than a narrow electoralist view of politics. He concludes his essay by noting that black politics is, quote, essentially a power struggle between blacks and whites, with the latter, whites, trying to maintain their superordinate position vis-a-vis the former, unquote. Now, while not agreeing with Jones's tendency to generalize, with Jones's tendency to generalize about whiteness and blackness, or his failure to appreciate social class questions, it's clear that African-American politics, unlike what's generously referred to in some quarters as, quote, American politics, unquote, but which often effectively means white American politics, black politics explicitly and rightly employs racial categories in response to an openly racial and indeed white supremacist American political culture. Additionally, as with any meaningful understanding of politics, white, brown, red, or any other, the quest for power, which means the ability to control or manage one's affairs and influence others to do what's in the best interest of your community. This is central to the black politics equation. So, African American politics is, or better yet, should be understood as, the struggle for power between the black community, including with its allies, between the black community and a small white ruling elite. This struggle, from the point of view of black politics, seeks to close the persistent and arguably deepening racial gap. And I want to emphasize what I just said. Seeking to close the persistent and arguably deepening racial gap in life chances separating blacks and whites in the United States, as well as changing what might be called existing social relations of power, and generally prepares the foundation for a more democratic and racially just America, locally as well as globally. Now, with that definition of black power, of black politics as backdrop, I'd like to see if we can connect that definition of black politics with the history of what I call black liberalism in the United States. Let's recall, first of all, that blacks have now been in the United States, including the British colonies that became the United States, exactly 380 years. This includes some 250 years as slaves, another 100 years or so under what used to be called Jim Crow segregation, something I know about firsthand, having grown up in the Deep South, and it includes continuing racial injustice since the Civil Rights Movement some 30 years ago. In fact, other than American Indians and arguably Hispanics, or as many prefer to call themselves, Latinos, whose roots date back to settlements in Spanish America and the Southwest to at least the 16th century, other than those groups, no one has a better claim on being an American in its fullest sense than African Americans. But the question that I pose, where are African Americans today, 380 years later, and what is the current status of African American politics? The formative period of modern African American politics dates from the post-Civil War era, and specifically the period from the 1880s to the 1920s. Following betrayals of blacks, following betrayals by both northern white political elites, as well as white agrarian and labor movements, notably the Populist and the Knights of Labor, blacks at the end of the 19th century began to turn inward, though not for long, and thus initiated a rich debate over the future of black America. Leaders such as T. Thomas Fortune, Booker T. Washington, Ida B. Wells, W.E.B. Du Bois, William Monroe Trotter, Mary Church Terrell, Marcus Garvey, and E. Philip Randolph, as well as movements and organizations such as Black Socialist Preachers, the American Negro Academy, the Afro-American League, the National Association of Colored Women, the Niagara Movement, the African Blood Brotherhood, and the Universal Negro Improvement Association were all part of rich, if often strident and tendentious, political debates over strategies and tactics, appropriate visions, and acceptable organizational forms that would serve the advancement of the race. There isn't much that has been discussed since the end of the Second World War regarding Black America by Black leaders and Black intellectuals that wasn't on the table at the beginning of this century. This is one of the principal reasons why a growing number of African American political scientists have been writing, to be sure, with various titles, about the failure of African American leadership. As a footnote to this point, just recently, I, along with 60 other Black political scientists around the country, and there aren't many more of us than that, but was asked, as part of a national or major national research project on Black leadership, to identify whom I regard as the five most important Black leaders in American history, measured by their impact, for good or bad, upon the well-being of Blacks in the United States. Well, frankly, I have not yet been able to come up with my list, except maybe the first two. And I think this is what a lot of us are debating and dealing with among Black political scientists in the country, this whole question of leadership at the end of the 20th century. Now, out of the aforementioned series of debates by Black leaders and intellectuals at the close of the last century and the beginning of the 20th century, Black liberalism, even if the phrase wasn't in use, emerged as the dominant political philosophy, and apart from momentary intrusions from a few other ideological forms, such as Garveyism in this century, it remains the dominant political philosophy among the mainstream Black leadership class. At its core, though there are variations on this theme depending upon the individual, organization, or movement in question, Black liberalism, which is at bottom a Black version of Euro-American liberalism, has meant a valuing of inclusion or integrationism, substituting color blindness for legal segregation, understanding politics, especially a kind of bourgeois electoralism, as the principal vehicle for Black advancement, embracing moneyed culture, and cultivating an ethic of dependency among Blacks. The quintessential organizational and individual embodiments of Black liberalism in this century have been, respectively, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, founded primarily by progressive-era whites in 1909, and Martin Luther King Jr., especially during what I regard as his early public life phase, 1955 through 1965. Now, even within the limitations suggested in the very meaning of Black liberalism, under the influence of this political philosophy, African Americans, since the end of the Second World War, and with the notable assistance of the Second World War itself and other external factors, and especially between 1940 and 1970, made substantial progress in closing the notorious racial gap between themselves and whites on numerous key measures of economic well-being. Median household income, business ownership, college education, impoverishment, and growth of a significant middle class, and the wide gulf in political participation has also narrowed considerably since 1965 in voter registration, voter turnout, and the number of elected officials. Still, and I emphasize that word, still, even in these areas of progress, even in these areas of progress, much remains to be done. Let's take a few examples from available Census Bureau data. Black median household income as a percentage of white median household income remains, and I repeat, remains at the 60% it was in 1970. Black per capita income is 56% of white per capita income, exactly what it was in 1970. And the wealth gap is even much worse, as median black household wealth is only 12% of the white figure. No real change since 1970. And let's note that despite the progress mentioned previously in the electoral arena, black elected officials are, in 1999, still only 1.6% of all elected officials in the country, about where it was in 1970, and this from a population that is just under 13% of all Americans. I could go on with figures relating to poverty, employment, and education, but I trust the point has been made. Now, apart from the limited reach, though important, of key measures of economic well-being indicated moments ago, two key measures of social and psychological acceptance of blacks by whites are far worse, omitting, of course, considerations for the popularity of many black entertainers, athletes, dancers, singers, comedians, and the like. Everybody likes blacks who can perform. But when you get to these two key measures of social and psychological acceptance, it's another matter. For example, most whites are extremely reluctant to live in a neighborhood where blacks exceed 20% of the population, and often will not do so at a percentage of about 10%. Similarly, there is considerable reluctance by most whites, as reflected by opinions and behavior, to intermarry with blacks. Demographers Roderick Harrison and Claudette Bennett recently wrote in a very good essay, quote, "The ultimate test of declining social distance and growing equality is acceptability as marriage partners," unquote. The data in both of these areas, intermarriage rates and residential segregation rates, are very clear. Asian and Pacific Islanders, and even Latinos, and especially American Indians, whatever the numerous injustices these groups face on other indices, and there are many, are acceptable to whites as neighbors and marital partners over blacks by wide margins. Census Bureau data confirms this, as well as numerous studies by sociologists and demographers. You might take a look at a two-volume work by Reynolds Farley, one of the country's most distinguished demographers, came out two or three years ago, The State of the Union. Excellent work, which bases itself upon Census Bureau data as well. Now, these key social and psychological measures of acceptance, more than key measures of economic well-being, though both are important, get to the heart of the problem with black liberalism as a political philosophy. Instead of trying to get in, quote unquote, or worse, force oneself in, quote unquote, if you will, African-American politics might be better understood, as Martin Luther King Jr. himself belatedly acknowledged, as a vehicle designed, to aid in the building of black institutions and organizing to radically transform America. Now, as we ponder these issues that I'm now raising, we need to ask ourselves, well, where do we go from here, given this, at best, mixed legacy, and at worst, a very dangerous condition that is bequeathed to the black population by the tradition that I've referred to as black liberalism. Now, against the backdrop, then, of the shortcomings of black liberalism, and in the spirit of what I call the later Public King phase of 1966, 1968, but transcending his agenda, black politics in the United States, if understood in my original formulation and with modes of accountability expected of black leaders, should be seen or designed as a theory of liberation that points toward self-determination as its fundamental project. Point toward self-determination as its fundamental project. That is, where African Americans attain the ability to effectively control their own affairs and build black institutions. But the ideal of black self-determination cannot and should not be decoupled from the construction of a radically transformative politics, which must constitute its foundation. To be sure, liberalism, in its origins and early development during the 16th through the 18th centuries in Western Europe, was indeed liberating, quote unquote, in that the individual, or better, white male individual, its unit of political analysis, was to be emancipated, at least formally, from the constraints of feudal institutions. This was a revolutionary idea, and justly deemed a direct threat to the reigning absolute monarchies in Europe and anywhere else in the world. Black liberalism, on the other hand, historically hostage to a kind of Jeffersonian racial logic, namely his quote-unquote staining the blood, unquote, of the white masters thesis. This Jeffersonian racial logic continues to undergird the thinking and especially behavior of much of white America, as black abolitionist David Walker predicted would be the case in his much known appeal to the colored citizens of the world in 1829. And additionally, this black liberalism emerged in the 20th century within the bowels of the most powerful capitalist edifice in the world, thereby is severely deficient in its failure to appreciate its own limitations, perhaps indeed its obsolescence, and the consequences thereby for the African-American community of not recognizing these limitations or appreciating these limitations, especially for the worst off segments of the black population at the end of the 20th century. Put another way, and I want to be very clear on this, put another way, the continuing problems that beset the black community are not just the effects of predatory capitalism and white supremacist ideology, even if these should be accorded primacy in any explanatory model, but also stem from defects that are presently internal or specific to the black community. Now, to say this, and I want to be clear again, is not to buy into what writer Ishmael Reed rightly refers to as, quote, the black pathology business, as seen, for example, to varying degrees in the writings of Cornel West in Race Matters, William Julius Wilson, The Truly Disadvantaged, Dinesh D'Souza, The End of Racism, Orlando Patterson, The Ordeal of Integration, and Stefan and Abigail Thernstrom, America in Black and White, where there is lots of money to be made on the basis of real equal opportunity from trashing and blaming the black poor, sometimes contemptuously referred to as the underclass, for their present station in the United States. So what I'm saying here with these points here is that black liberalism arose in an era, okay, and positioned itself with an outlook which was incompatible with fundamental black advancement. The liberalism from which it derives, that is to say, Euro-American liberalism of the 16th through the 18th century, certainly was progressive in its early period, and indeed revolutionary. But this liberalism has contributed to hampering continuing black advancement in the 20th century and as we move to the 21st century. So, I conclude, and I'll open up, with the observation that the future of African-American politics turns on the simultaneous rejection of black liberalism and the development of a political philosophy that values genuine black self-determination and recognizes that the effort to attain this ideal requires appropriately positioning the black population within progressive efforts to change existing social relations of power and thus create a more democratic and racially just America, locally and globally. Thank you. Well, I've laid out the sketch, the outline of my talk, and I'm prepared to expand upon themes raised in this talk by way of an exchange. Or if you want to put a noose up here and string me up, I'm prepared to do that as well. Okay. All right, any comments or questions, reactions to my presentation? Harry. Sure.
Who's writing in vain beside you presentation?
Well, I can think of a number of people. I would say James Jennings would be an excellent example of this. His focus has been on urban studies. He's a political scientist at University of Massachusetts, Boston, former director of the William Monroe Trotter Institute. Excellent scholar, and he and I have been pushing a lot of folks to rethink not just black leadership in general, but the political philosophy behind the leadership. And so I think he would be an example. Certainly, we have activists out there as well, other than just scholars. We have, of course, Ron Daniels, based in New York City. He embraces some of this approach as well. So obviously, it's not an approach that is uniformly accepted, at least with some of the edges that I put on it. But certainly, most progressive black political scientists certainly would be critical, sharply critical, of African American leadership. Particularly given the dilemmas that continue to beset the black population in the United States.
Yeah. Where would you place
Manning? Manning is probably, and I know Manning well, good friend. I would say Manning, he identifies himself as a socialist, and certainly he's critical of black liberalism and calls for a revolutionary transformation of the United States. But Manning is much less of a nationalist than I am. My agenda is, in some sense, much like Patricia Hill Collins. Some of you may know her, the author of Black Feminist Thought. Patricia Hill Collins, and some people have difficulty understanding this, but what her agenda, as I understand it, and certainly based on what she said to me and what I've read in her book, is to find a way to bridge the chasm that traditionally has separated black nationalism and feminism, including black feminism. And that's part of her project. I see myself, to some extent, in the same ballpark, in the sense that what I'm trying to do is find a way to bridge some aspects of black nationalism with radically transformative politics. And that has been historically problematic for a lot of reasons. going back to the days of the old left in this country in the 1920s and the 1930s. But certainly that's part of my agenda, to try to bridge the gap between those two. And I mentioned a moment ago Jennings as well, and that's his project, a part of it as well, as I understand it, and based on conversations that we've had. Yeah. Yes. Well, I think there was a tremendous effort to do that a few years ago when Ben Chavis, no longer Ben Chavis, Ben Chavis was the director of the executive director of the NAACP. But he had other baggage. We had some baggage with him in terms of his personal life, and that fell through. But the idea was to reform the leading organizations in the black community, among them the NAACP, to make such organizations, and I'm just mentioning that one because that's an example of this, to make such organizations more attractive in terms of a kind of a program that might appeal to some of the concerns that animate many young blacks, young people in this country. And that's one way to do it. Of course, other things that might be done, of course, would be for us to come up as intellectuals, as scholars, come up with ways to incorporate blacks in various movements. And of course, that's being done with the Black Radical Congress, the phenomenon that was created a couple of years ago. And I think, so there are some efforts out there in which folks are beginning to find ways to incorporate young blacks into political movements and organizations. But it's a difficult task because they're swimming upstream right now, given some of the dimensions of hip-hop culture and where things are headed there. And so I think it is a problem. There's no question about that. But I think there are some things that are going on the local levels, from what I understand, in Detroit and some other places, where folks are beginning to rethink some of these organizations and movement strategies to understand that it's important to have young people involved. I mean, let's remember, the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement were led by young people. Okay, young people always make revolutions. What we call Black Studies today. We're right now in the midst of trying to create, Harry knows this, we're part of the same committee, trying to create an African-American studies program here at Michigan State University. But of course, a lot of people don't know this, but that, of course, came out of, originally, the black student movement at predominantly white institutions, okay? At Berkeley, at San Francisco State University, in Ann Arbor, and elsewhere, okay? And I think we have to understand that, and we have to know that history, that it's young people who participate and organize. SNCC, okay? Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. College students, okay, participating in the sit-down strikes, in the efforts to get blacks registered to vote in Mississippi, et cetera, et cetera. These were black college students, okay, basically from North Carolina universities, historically black institutions, rallying to the civil rights cause. So I think it is important to understand that history, and I think you rightly mentioned that, hey, we need to do that again and not get worked up about issues having to do with Munfield and things of that nature. Not that a lot of blacks were involved with that, but certainly it was an issue with young people. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Yes. Oh, Barry, how you doing? Okay. Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. That is, you know, one of the things that we don't appreciate often among blacks, native-born African-Americans, and whites as well, is that the black population is not homogenous. It never has been, okay? We've always had class divisions, certainly greater today than ever, but we've always had class divisions. We've always had distinctions between light-skinned blacks and dark-skinned blacks. We've always had traitors. I mean, after all, Denmark Vesey and Gabriel Prosser and many of the those who were organizing resistance against enslavement were turned in by blacks, okay? So I think we have to understand this diversity, but to the point that you're making, among all the major groups among communities of color today, okay, blacks are really the most, if you like, native population. There's no real foreign-born component among blacks. It's increasing, but it's not really here. It's about 5%. The most recent, in fact, the Census Bureau just published in their 1997 report on the number of and percentages of foreign-born populations in the United States, and they had the breakdown, the Asian Americans. Okay, I mean, 70 Asian Pacific Islanders, 70% are foreign-born from that population. Latinos, it's about 40%. Okay, but with blacks, and of course Indians, American Indians, but with blacks, it's 5%. And those populations tend to come, obviously, from the Caribbean and from Africa. And of course, not everybody who comes from Africa is black. Some 30% of the people who come into this country from Africa self-identify as white. And they're not just all white South Africans. Okay? So I think, to answer you directly, we have to find a way to understand that African Americans, that definition, cannot be understood narrowly. We have to reach out, we have to recognize that there are differences between blacks and some of these other groups. For example, as was mentioned in the introduction, I was in New York City for about 3 years, and I lived right on the edge of Harlem, in fact, in Harlem, and although, of course, at Columbia University, they call that area where Columbia is Morningside Heights. I don't know what that means, but really, it's Harlem, okay? But they call it something else to distance themselves from that. But the point I'm making here is this, is that there was tension there. It was illustrated on the various radio talk shows, the different newspapers, and I think we have to understand why that difference is there, but the fact of the matter is it's there. Similarly, in Miami, there have been tensions between blacks, African Americans, and Haitian immigrants, not to mention the Cubans, as well as with other groups. So I think we have these difficulties, and there is this diversity within the black community, but at the same time, we're going to have to find a way to bridge the differences. And one of the things we're doing with this African American Studies program is that we don't see, and this gives you an indication of my thinking, we don't see such an African American Studies program as simply focused on the black experience in the United States. We're also interested in connecting globally with the black experience elsewhere in the Caribbean and, of course, in Africa especially. So I think that's the approach we have to adopt, and some of us are thinking like this. Although it's an uphill battle to some extent, particularly in some parts of the country where the tension is much greater than you would find right here in East Lansing, for sure. Okay. I saw another hand in the back. Ah, yeah. Dorothy. I'm calling all the names out. It seems like I know everybody. Yeah, yeah, I'll be happy to. I mean, it's not, you know, I didn't give much thought to that comment. That's a comment I didn't give a lot of thought to. But what I had in mind when I made the comment was that certainly there has been a tendency within that movement, within that culture, to go in various directions. There are some segments of the entertainment industry which suggests that there is a political component to this. But on the other hand, there is the traditional emphasis on moneyed culture, getting ahead, and simply tapping into aspects of the black tradition for the sake of self-aggrandizement, getting whatever one can out of the black community, or in this instance, especially as well, also the white population, because obviously much of the funding comes from that area. That's what I had in mind. It was nothing in particular. Yeah. I saw another hand somewhere here. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Which I've said as myself. Yeah. Right.
I mean, but even the issue, when you get to transformative politics, it's a class issue too.
For him, it's especially class. He doesn't want to hear black nationalism, not to the extent that I think needs to be. Yeah. Well, first of all, it seems to me that. If blacks are to advance in this country, we've got to take control of our own agenda. Now that hasn't always been the case, okay? Before, I mean, Adolf certainly knows the history of political coalitions in this country. You heard me mention the populist and the Knights of Labor in the 19th century. I could mention a whole slew of efforts on the part of blacks to coalesce with various groups in this country, including the left, including the Jewish population, Jewish organizations. Including women's groups, and things have gone wrong, okay? And it ends up that these other groups, some of them, tend to come out of these relationships better positioned to move ahead than is the case for blacks. So it's my perspective that while radically transformative politics are important, it is equally important for blacks to have a sense of and a firm understanding and appreciation for their own agenda. And that's why the emphasis for me has been on self-determination rather than simply on class politics. Now, how you bring these two together has been very, very difficult because the groups that blacks have been in coalition with, whether on the left or among liberals, have often had positions of influence and power and resources that blacks did not have in those early days of coalition politics. So what I've been encouraging people to do, and I think not just me, a lot of other folks are doing, is to continue to embrace the idea of race-based and other forms of coalition politics, but also recognize the limitations of such efforts and the possibilities for undermining efforts at black advancement. So that's the difference between me and some of the others, and I think it's an important distinction. And therefore, my position would lead me, for example, to be fascinated with the possibility, the prospects of an independent black political formation, okay? My position, for example, would lead me to say, on some occasions, well, what do we mean when we talk about people of color, okay? What do we mean when we talk about multiculturalism and diversity? Are these just updated versions of traditional liberalism that's been paraded by the black liberals? In this instance, it's the radical left, okay, that constitutes, in my view, the culprits. And this is where Manning Marable and I sometime, and we had these debates in New York City. This is where we differ, okay? Because I, not that I'm opposed to working with Latinos, with Asians, with American Indians, but it seems to me, okay, that you have to think about your own agenda as those groups should do as well, okay? And I think there's something else, and I hope you caught what I said earlier regarding intermarriage rates. Now, there is a possibility, and by the way, in the book that I'm editing, and I'm going to leak out something here, okay? In the book that I'm editing, a collection based on the race conference that I played a role in last April, which comes out, well, we hope sometime over the summer, early fall, by MSU Press. We have several scholars in there who were participants in the race conference and who raised this question about how differing rates of racial intermarriage will impact upon how we come to understand race in the 21st century. Now, I mentioned, for example, American Indians, okay, in my presentation. American Indians, for example, intermarry with whites about 70%. Okay. 70% of American Indians intermarry, which is fine, I have nothing against that. That's their business. I'm just saying this to give you an indication of what's going on. At 70% of American Indian men and women intermarry with whites. They have spouses. One or the other is a white person. Okay. With Asian Americans, Asian Pacific Islanders, it's around 50%. And growing. And for some groups, it's well above 50%, like Japanese, okay? For Latinos, it's about 40%. For blacks, in the most recent statistics we have from the Census Bureau, they have, you know, one of the things about the internet, you know, we just go get that stuff. And I'm constantly going to the links, you know, to find that stuff. What do you find for blacks? Well, the rate right now is about 9%, just over 9%. Okay. Intermarriage rate between blacks and whites. Now, what some demographers are saying, sociologists are saying, is that increasingly we may end up with a situation that whiteness will be again redefined. The net will be widened, as it was, to include the Irish and the Jews. Okay? You know, race is a political concept, okay? As we know, some of us do. Okay? It's a political concept, sociological concept. It has nothing to do with biology, in my opinion, although I'm not an anthropologist, physical anthropologist, or any other. But based on what I've read and what I know, it's just not there. The point here that I'm making is that at some point in the next century or the century after, if immigration patterns continue with more and more Asians and Latinos, and intermarriage rates among those groups continue to skyrocket, which is fine, I have nothing against this, there may be an effort, as whites increasingly become the presently existing whites, become a minority, they may want to redefine whiteness. It makes it easier to hold on to privilege and power and wealth. If you redefine whiteness, you don't necessarily accord those privileges to these new white groups, but you widen the net, okay? And therefore, you'll end up with another version of the old Kerner Report, the two-nation thesis, redefined. The two-nation thesis was introduced by the Kerner Report, you may remember, in 1968. It predicted that the United States, if present trends continue, meaning, of course, racial segregation and the like, would end up as two nations, one black, one white, separate, and unequal. I mean, that's the fancy language that they used in their conclusion. Now, of course, there are some folks a decade or two or so afterwards who were saying, well, they were wrong, and da-da-da-da-da. But some of us are now beginning to say, well, wait a minute. They may be right, but not in the way that they thought about it. We may still end up with two nations, okay? A larger white population by way of a redefinition of whiteness, and, of course, the blacks on the outside who don't intermarry, okay? Or who are not acceptable as marriage partners by whites, okay? And this goes back to the beginning of this country's history, if you know about the black-white thing and Thomas Jefferson and the whole range of things as to why the white population is so vehemently opposed to intermarrying with blacks, okay? The National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago, which is as good as any in terms of mapping public opinion, in the around 1993, and they're one of their social science surveys in 1993, 1994, found that nearly 60% of whites in the United States say they are opposed in principle marriage to a black person. This is the 90s. This is not 1960. Okay? This is 1990s. Okay? And of course, in fact, whites behave that way as well. Okay? And the same, and you may remember these measures that I mentioned. Some of you, I hope you caught the point. I'm not opposed to speaking to measures of economic well-being. Those are important, and those may be the ones that we should focus on. Unfortunately, black liberalism was also interested in the other, which is part of the problem I was getting at. Measures of social acceptance, that's part of traditional liberalism. If we prove ourselves, we can become accepted by the white population, et cetera. And clearly that's not the case. With regard to blacks. These other groups are far more acceptable. Don't misunderstand me. Many of these key measures of economic well-being, there are some Latino populations that are worse off than blacks, Puerto Ricans, for example, and Chicanos, for example, with education. In South Vietnamese, okay? Oh, pardon me, South Vietnamese. Vietnamese, okay? And Cambodians. So it's not the issue of the numbers. It's a question of the psychology of whiteness and how blacks are perceived, okay? There's something different about the perception of black people that transcends, by whites, that transcends economic categories. I'll concede these other points, that Puerto Ricans are worse off than blacks in a number of economic categories. The numbers are clear, they are. But that's not what matters here, okay? It's, are blacks to be viewed in the same way as other Americans? And we've always had to fight an uphill battle in that regard, okay? And I think that's a critical difference, and it goes back to the racial classification schemes from the 18th and 19th century, and a whole range of things that kind of set blacks apart in those areas in ways that are not applicable to many of the other groups. Yeah. Other comments? Yeah, Lewis. Oh, sorry. Either of you. Lewis first, and then over here. And transformative politics, yeah.
What will be the future of black politics in American
In American what?
Mainstream.
Blacks will continue to play a role in mainstream politics in this country. There's no question about that. But, you know, increasingly, I'm not so sure how far we can go unless something radically changes in this country. Let me give an example. You heard me say that since 1970, we have not made African Americans any real progress in getting more blacks elected in the United States. The question is why, okay? And part of the reason is we're running out of black districts, okay? And that means now that blacks have to campaign statewide and run for statewide offices. And when you run from statewide offices and you're black, that means you're going to have to go out to the rural areas and this area and that area, and they ain't going to vote for you, okay? Generally, that's the case. I've seen the numbers. When I say they, I'm talking about most whites, not all whites, most whites will not vote for blacks unless the politics are deracialized, okay? And there may be a possibility then. And in fact, that's one of the big debates now among black political scientists. Every year we meet somewhere down south, typically. This year we're going to be in Washington, D.C. I look forward to that. The National Conference of Black Political Scientists. And there's this raging debate now about the implications of the deracialization of the black agenda. You see it cropping up in a number of cities with black mayors, Baltimore and elsewhere, Detroit, okay? A deracialized agenda. No longer do we have the Coleman Youngs. Whatever Coleman Young's fault, he would call a spade, okay, an attempt to move in certain directions that were favorable to blacks. There are those who would argue that, and this is, I don't want to be too harsh towards Dennis Archer, but there are those who would argue that this is the phenomenon that might contribute to blacks expanding their base in mainstream politics by the process of deracialization. But is that acceptable? Is that what should be done? Should it be required? If the issues that confront blacks require a racial response, because the circumstances are defined by race, white supremacy. How do you deal with that? Well, do you cover it up? Do you smother it? Do you not talk about it? I mean, these are the kind of things that we're debating now as more and more black politicians, would-be politicians, are deracializing their efforts. Okay? And that may be the solution, if it is a solution. Yeah. Oh, and then over here. Yeah. Yeah, please.
What do you think
about the race? Well, I'm in favor of deracialization, but not the kind of deracialization that's going on. Certainly, I think race as a concept ought to be deconstructed. I think we ought to transcend race at some point. I mean, I've already said that race is a meaningless category from the standpoint of biology. But at the same time, I think that race becomes important right now for blacks because of the circumstances that blacks face, based on some of the things that I've said here. But I think in the last analysis, we're going to have to find a way to move beyond that. And the way to do it is not to think in terms of moving beyond it within the context of the existing circumstances, the existing political framework. That's the point I was making. Not a point against deracialization, but the kind of deracialization. Okay? Well, I guess. Oh, yeah, there you are. Yeah, I forgot. Sorry. Well, up close to 60%, according to the National Opinion Research Center.
I would be curious to know how much that
is. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. There's no question, but that there is, it's not anywhere near that, okay? Most blacks are not opposed in principle to intermarrying with white, but the number is rising. There is I don't have the exact figure in front of me, so I don't want to cite it, because I don't have the figure at the top of my head, but it's well under 50%, well under, okay? Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah. No, I think no. Yeah, well, that's true. I think we're all guilty of that. But I think you're right. I think the hope is with many of the people sitting out here. Okay. I agree. Others? Well, I thank you very much for your attention. And hopefully, you know, we had some interesting exchanges here. I'll turn it back over to you now.
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for having us.